From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The final day of voting in Georgia's high-stakes Senate runoffs is underway. Today's elections will determine which party controls the Senate, and that will ultimately determine how difficult or easy it'll be for President-elect Joe Biden to get his agenda through Congress. Let's check back in with Emil Moffitt, a reporter at member station WABE in Atlanta. And Emil, both Senate seats are up for grabs in Georgia, and polls have been open for several hours already now today. What are you seeing? How are things going?
Mostly smooth. No reports of really long lines or major technical snags so far this morning. There have been a few smaller counties that have seen some problems with the voting machines and had to go to emergency paper ballots, but nothing in the metro counties. And that's been for good news for voters like Susanna Duran, who works for a Latino outreach group. She was first in line this morning as polls opened at Pittman Park Recreational Center in Southwest Atlanta. She says she just didn't have the time to vote early as polling places adjusted to hours over the holidays.
I should have voted earlier, but it's been so busy. I work in elections too. So we've been organizing and it's just been so wild all these hours.
And it's interesting that the early voting period was around Christmas and New Year's this year. So people did go out to vote, even though it's been a very busy time of year to have a runoff election.
Well, in fact, it looks like 3 million people went out and cast their ballots during that early voting period. So taking that and what you're also seeing there at the polls today, how does this election compare to previous runoffs in terms of turnout? What does it say about the enthusiasm in this election?
It says a lot. Normally, you do see a pretty big drop off from the general to the runoff election. But while turnout was down slightly from the general election in November, it's still really robust in this runoff elections. And that, I think, speaks to the national implications of this race. And of course, voters on both sides of the aisle say it'll affect not only the national landscape, but also their everyday lives as well.
You told us that things appear to be going smoothly so far today, but at a press conference yesterday, a top state election official, Gabriel Sterling, had this morning.
We anticipate there could be any number of potential threats out there that could be attempting to encourage or discourage turnout. We encourage everybody to please turn out, be safe, be smart, and don't let anybody get in the way of you casting your vote.
So what do we know about those threats and what kind of precautions are being taken?
The threats have been described as vague, but county officials have been preparing for weeks, working with law enforcement there in each county to make sure voters and election employees are safe. But it should be noted that we have seen and continue to see threats made against county officials, against state officials, including Gabriel Sterling, the official we just heard from, as well as some lawmakers following the very contentious November election and the aftermath.
Well, it has been contentious, and look no further to the rally that President Trump had in Georgia yesterday. He spent most of it repeating baseless claims of voter fraud and falsely said that he won the state in November. It was the same message we heard in that phone call with Georgia's Republican Secretary of State over the weekend. Have you heard anything more in the past 24 hours? I know we had you on yesterday to talk about this phone call, but have you heard anything more if Trump's constant undermining of Georgia's voting system is impacting the race today or turnout today?
As far as turnout goes, we're seeing similar numbers to what we saw on Election Day in November, kind of a steady flow of voters, but no major lines like we've seen in past elections. So I think it might actually be tonight when polls close, when we're able to get kind of a good gauge of the full effects of President Trump's continued baseless claims of fraud. But from some of the supporters of President Trump we've talked to, it seems like most are kind of holding their noses and going to the polls anyway. But with the races so close, every vote is going to be important. And so if there are just a few holdouts, that could affect the race.
Polls close tonight at 7 Eastern. How long before we know the outcome of this election? Could it be a really drawn out process like we saw in the general back in November?
There's a potential for it to be. Counties did have a jump start on processing the absentee ballots. They were able to start 2 weeks ago processing the ballots, and they had to start a week ago getting through those. But there are 1 million absentee ballots to count in this runoff election, so it very likely could be a day or two, especially depending on how close these races end up being.
All right, we'll be there to watch it. Emil Moffitt, a reporter at member station WABE in Atlanta. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Well, in an effort to get the coronavirus vaccine into the arms of Americans, some medical professionals have been floating this idea of giving single doses like they're doing in the UK. But the Food and Drug Administration says right now they're not recommending any dosing changes here in the U.S. Both the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna vaccines require two doses taken weeks apart. And for now, it looks like it will stay that way. For more on the science behind this, let's bring in Michael Mina, an epidemiologist and physician at Harvard. Doctor, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, Doctor, the idea of the single dose is so that the vaccine can reach twice as many people. You want there to be more research into this, but you believe it actually could be a good idea. Why?
What we're seeing now is we're at a critical point in this pandemic, of course, where we have an extraordinary number of cases that are out and about in this country and in the greater world. People are dying at huge numbers, almost 4,000 a day, some days today in the U.S. alone. So the faster we can get more vaccines into more people's arms, the better, especially the most vulnerable people. Now, we don't want to do this without data or evidence, so we want to run the trials, and we want to start the trials today, and there are efficient ways to do it. But the point is, if we can figure out how to more efficiently get more doses out to more people in the same amount of time that we would otherwise get individuals vaccinated with two doses, we could potentially have a much greater impact on saving lives and reducing spread of this virus in the near term.
I understand exactly what you're saying. You know, both Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, though, are over 90% effective after two doses. How effective are they after a single dose? And I understand that you're asking for more research on this, but if this is something that we're going to do in the immediate future, these are questions we have to be asking.
So we know from the trials, from the phase three trials of both Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, that we saw around a 90% or 92% efficacy after one dose and before the second dose going out to a month. Now, it wasn't studied beyond a month because people ended up getting the second dose. But there have been some post-hoc analyses people have looked at of those people who only ended up getting one dose for whatever reason. What was the efficacy? And that seemed to remain at around 90%. So the data wasn't clean because that wasn't part of the trial, but it at least gives us a window to have that as a baseline. We know that there was good protection in the short term after a single dose. And so then the question becomes more an optimization question. If you extend that out for more than 1 month and you go to 2 months or 3 months or maybe 6 months, how much efficacy do you lose after just a single dose? And how does that compare to what the effect of not giving twice as many people a vaccine because you're giving everyone two doses instead of one? And so those are how we're thinking of balancing and sort of weighing the choices here.
Do you think we really have time to study this, or is there a benefit? I guess that's the question you're asking, is just to adopt that approach to get more shots out right now.
I think we could start. You know, the phase three trials were only most people in the phase three trials didn't even go out for a full 3 months. So we could have started in mid-December. We could start today. And there's ways that we could do this today. A lot of people have already gotten one vaccine, especially in the healthcare sector. There's a lot of people in healthcare who don't actually see patients who have now received vaccines. For example, myself, I'm a pathologist. But in general, I'm never in the hospital these days because I work on different issues than seeing patients. But I'm eligible for a vaccine. So had I gotten a vaccine 2 weeks ago, maybe I would be willing to enroll and say, you know what, I'm not going to get my second dose. So we've already bought ourselves 2 weeks of time into this trial. And if we could go out for 2 months and maybe 3 months, you know, then we could really start to understand more. But to your point, this is a critical question at this moment. We have huge numbers of cases, and I think that the argument could be made to think about at least spacing them out. It doesn't have to be one dose versus two doses. It could be one dose versus a second dose 2 or 3 months later, or at the very least, let's not keep the second doses in the freezer just to make sure they're there. let's just let the supply, the constant supply of vaccines that we are expecting, keep up to pace. And so we can stop, we don't end up stowing away a bunch of vaccines in a freezer while other people could be using them. But instead, we just keep vaccinating people on a rotating basis. So there's a lot of different ways that we could be doing this much more efficiently than we are at the moment.
It's Dr. Michael Mina, an epidemiologist, immunologist, and physician at Harvard. And we'll link you to his New York Times opinion piece at hereandnow.org. Doctor, thank you so much.
Happy to be here. Thanks a lot.
John Ridley is the Academy Award-winning screenwriter for serious films like 12 Years a Slave. But he's also into comic books, both as a reader and a writer. He created The American Way back in 2006, as well as its sequel. And now he's putting his own spin on the heroes of the DC universe. Ridley has a couple of comic book projects coming out. The five-part series, The Other History of the DC Universe, which looks at historical events and alternate storylines for DC heroes like Superman and Black Lightning. Book two comes out later this month. And out today is the first issue of Ridley's Future State, The Next Batman, which has a black character, Tim Fox, taking over as the mega-rich Cape Crusader following the apparent death of Bruce Wayne. John Ridley joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. How are you holding up?
Oh, you know what? I'm holding up. How about you?
I'm blessed despite myself, so I'm good. Thanks.
That's a good way to put it, in spite of myself. That is the same way with me. Well, this new Batman, he's a character that really seems to be right on time for some because of the moment we're in, and probably about time for others who've been waiting to see themselves in superheroes. Was that your intention?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I think some ways, yes and no. I mean, I think very unfortunately, a lot of my work has always been the perfect work for imperfect moments. I'm very thankful for the lot of work that I've done, you know, Red Tails, 12 Years, Guerrilla, American Crime. But it feels like it's always been, you know, people have asked that same question. It's like, wow, how does it feel to have this work coming at this very raw moment? And unfortunately, it seems like these moments are becoming more and more raw. Some of that is because all of us are becoming just so much more aware of these things that are happening on a cycle. But I would be equally as happy if some of this work came out and it just stood on its own.
Tim Fox, the new Batman, is the son of Lucius Fox, a character that will be familiar to even a casual reader of Batman or someone who's seen Morgan Freeman play the character in the most recent Batman films. Tell us more about that storyline.
What I wanted to nexus this new Batman around was family and very grounded issues. So to have a young man who is this son, who went away, why did he go away? What were those stress points with his family? What had he been doing all of these years? Why very particularly did he want or need to become Batman? You know, he has a brother who's Batwing. Okay, so his story's told. And yes, you know, Luke could become Batman. But for me, you know, Tim, he was there, but at the same time, there's an opportunity to really get into the specificity of this character. And for me as a writer at this point in my life, specificity matters. Real motivations, even for an unreal character, they matter.
Specificity matters. It's also what makes stories stick with us, that specificity, because in that specificity, we often see ourselves.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, for me, you know, at this point, it's not just writing what I hope is a really terrific character with Tim, but it's the entire Fox family. You know, I'm a dad now. I'm a husband now. I have kids who are around Tim's age, and to be able to say, you know, how does Tim's decision affect this entire family? That's what really excites me at this point, is that it's not just about Batman. It's about this family, and it's about a family of color, and it's about a family of color who are now about the richest people on the planet. So what are all these things, and what are we saying, and what are we saying about identity and responsibility and privilege that are unique to the bat world, but aren't necessarily unique to the world, but also aren't things that we necessarily unpack often. A black family that has a different responsibility, a black family that's going to be looked at differently, a black family that has means, but do those means insulate them, elevate them, protect them in the same way Bruce Wayne was?
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about something we should mention that some diehard comic book fans have pointed out, that Stan Lee created a black Batman for his comic book series, Just Imagine. What's the difference between the two?
To me, and I don't say this against Stan or for my writing, but there are people, for example, and I think this may be a better way of saying it, they'll say, oh, hey, you're writing black Batman. And they're excited about it. They're like, well, that's really, really cool. And I say, well, I'm not writing black Batman. I'm writing a Batman, and he happens to be black, but more importantly, he is Tim Fox. And his version of Batman is going to be completely different if it was his brother or if his sister became a bat person. It has to be specific.
There's a theme with your work here. You're also involved in the other history of the DC universe. Part one of that series came out in November, and the series elevates a number of characters like Black Lightning. They're not the main superheroes we're used to seeing in the spotlight. How does it feel to contribute to a world that so many of us live in as kids, worlds where we can stretch our imaginations and possibilities, and specifically worlds where the characters look like you and me? I mean, you've been talking so much about that, about the importance of specificity. But this has got to be exciting. You're part of really changing the hearts and minds of a new generation.
Yeah, I really don't think the prevailing culture understands how important it is for people to see themselves in entertainment, in the world, to inspire lightly just by, oh, here's a hero, here's a person, here's an icon. I still think about my dad taking me to see the Christopher Reeve Superman film, and I could not have loved that film more. I could not have been more inspired as a kid, and I loved that film. I love it to this day. And that's great. But I also think about when my wife and I took our kids to see Black Panther and what that meant, not just seeing a hero and loving it and loving that sort of wish fulfillment, but seeing Chadwick, seeing a Wakanda, seeing Afrofuturism, and then also seeing the millions of people around the world who felt the same way about Black Panther that I felt about Christopher Reeve. Race didn't matter. It was the heroic nature of what these folks were doing. And as much as I love 12 Years, as much as I love Red Tails or American Crime, you know, Black Panther pushed the narrative and pushed representation and pushed acceptance in ways that, you know, these kind of serious, important films, I love what I do, but it's just different. You know, these stories I'm telling right now with DC, with these heroes, this is the best time of my life. It really, really is a storyteller. So I'm thankful for all the things that I've done, but there's no, you know, there's a reason that these stories endure. There's a reason that these are, when it comes to mass storytelling that everybody buys into, you know, this is the thing that endures right now, are these superhero stories. So I'm very happy, very fortunate to be part of it.
One thing that you did, you visited beloved characters like Superman in this series, and you've pointed out that Superman is an immigrant and an alien from another planet. And that kind of blew my mind, John, just thinking of him in this way.
Well, you know, Superman, how he represents, and I think there's a reality that, you know, there are all kinds of immigrants in our country. And when we talk about the problems of immigration, we, you know, tend to think about immigration from the southern border and not folks coming from other places where they look a little bit more like the prevailing culture. And their immigrant story, you know, right now is not, you know, it's historically lauded. For me, the great thing about the other history, it's not just, okay, well, you know, Superman was bad because he, you know, is an alien and an immigrant, but he represents Anglo. But even people wrapping their heads around, well, we got Superman wrong, you know, Black Lightning, having to look at it and say, okay, what did I get wrong about this guy? And how do I feel about him, and how do we feel about each other? You know, the great thing about the other history is that DC really allowed me to get deep. And, you know, their thing was, you know, if, yes, you're going to make Superman a drug dealer, we're going to have a problem with that. But if you're just talking about how we view each other and can we see ourselves in each other and where do all of us fall short, that's real. And that's what audiences have amazingly responded to. And that first issue was just, you know, you could feel it. And in the folks that I've talked to, it's just been like, wow, this is, you are treating these characters like real people and they deeply appreciate that.
I'm thinking about what you said, this is the best time of your life, and thinking about all of the work that you've done in the past and all of your accomplishments.
You know, you get to be a kid again. You get to be grown up and be a kid and play with toys. You get to go back to your youth. Coming out, there's a Superman that's Red and Blue, which is a series, and I got to contribute a story. And the story that I contributed, you know, really deals with the first comic book that I ever read. To have, you know, the comic book company that you loved as a kid say, you know, if you want to go back and represent Closure, you know, have at it. And that was really, really special to be able to do something where my kids are excited about it, to be able to do things where I can go to my kids literally and go, hey, I'm telling this story and there are other heroes that I want to use. And let me know who you'd really be interested in, to be able to use heroes that look like their mom and say to them, hey, who does this hero remind you of? And they get excited about that. Yeah, this is the absolute best space, best time for me as a storyteller.
John Ridley talking with us about his latest projects, Future State, The Next Batman, and The Other History of the DC Universe. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you very much. Please continue to stay well in these difficult times. Blessings to you.
And you can see images from both of John Ridley's projects at hereandnow.org.
The New York Stock Exchange is ditching plans to delist three Chinese telecom giants. The reversal comes just 4 days after the exchange announced it would remove China Telecom, China Mobile, and China Unicom in response to a November executive order from President Trump. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, I'm going to bring you in here because I need some help understanding this. The Trump order essentially banned investments in 35 Chinese companies, including the parent companies of the three I just mentioned. So why is the New York Stock Exchange not delisting them as planned?
It's actually confusing, and you can read into this several ways. If you want to take the NYSE at face value, it's at least taking its time with such an action. I mean, it's pretty draconian after it said it consulted with regulators. There was some anxiety about forced selling at a time when the shares were under pressure. But the other read is maybe the mood internally suddenly shifted in the waning days of the Trump administration, and they reassessed with the Biden White House on deck.
Oh, I see. In other words, the Biden administration might come in and overrule that executive order or something like that?
Well, U.S. investors otherwise would have had to wait until November to sell their holdings. We will have to see the follow-through from the Biden administration. There is bipartisan momentum to be tough on Beijing, but something changed in the past 5 or 6 days within the NYSE.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll maybe wait to see more details there. But the three big companies we're talking about here, they're state-owned. How big of a blow would it be, really, to delist them?
I mean, it's more symbolic. For its part, China's securities regulator had said that this executive order was politically driven, that the telcos themselves revealed that their U.S.-listed shares represented about 3-8% of their overall global tradable shares and at most about 20% of trading volumes. So it's an annoyance, but don't forget that China is not capital starved. It's on its way to becoming the globe's number one economy. It has all sorts of avenues to capital and trillions of U.S. dollars to boot. So this hardly chokes off these kind of national champion companies.
And just briefly remind us, I mean, President Trump has been tough on China the entire time he's been in the White House. But what was the motivation to sign this order banning U.S. investment in these companies?
Look, there's undeniable prestige to being U.S. listed. China Mobile has been on the NYSE for more than 20 years. China Unicom and China Telecom for almost as long. That telegraph status, it makes the shares obviously accessible and less exotic to U.S. institutional investors. By blacklisting them, the Trump administration was stripping them of kind of a capital route nominally, but mostly of the imprimatur of a Wall Street listing, which is still kind of the gold standard the world over.
I see. All right, just got about a minute left here to go, but I want to ask you about a related story. Chinese tech tycoon Jack Ma I guess you could say he's missing. The Alibaba co-founder was last seen in late October when he made a speech accusing Chinese regulators of stifling innovation, and that's not the first time that he clashed with the Chinese government. What do we know about Jack Ma and what's happened to
him? Well, it's an interesting confluence of headlines because it shows you how far China's capital markets still have to go culturally with what we have in the U.S. Jack Ma is one of the world's richest men, a rock star in China. He, for his part, you know, he said through friends that he's hanging low after he made critical comments about Chinese regulators. He does need Beijing to be on his side. And so I think this is a, you know, two dogs trying to stare one another down and which one shows his neck first. And it seems like Ma's holding back.
Hanging low is better than the alternative. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Trump supporters and members of far-right political groups are marching in Washington, D.C. today ahead of a scheduled vote in Congress tomorrow that will certify the results of the presidential election. WAMU reporter Michaela LaFrac is in Washington, and she's been watching as these protests develop. Michaela, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And this is the third pro-Trump rally in D.C. since the election, and officials are preparing for even larger crowds, it sounds like, to descend on the city this time. What are you seeing?
That's right. Well, an afternoon rally just kicked off about 40 minutes ago at Freedom Plaza, which is right by the White House. They're having an afternoon and evening rally there, and Republican political operative Roger Stone, a conspiracy theorist and conservative radio host Alex Jones are expected to speak later. I don't have a clear crowd estimate for you, but their permit is for about 5,000 people. And honestly, the streets are really starting to fill up in downtown D.C. with folks in Trump gear, big American flags, most folks not wearing masks. And then briefly, we'll talk more about tomorrow in a second, I know, but the city is also preparing for President Trump to potentially make an appearance at tomorrow's rally. And that has caused the National Park Service to bump up its crowd estimate for tomorrow from about 5,000 to 30,000 people. So we really could see some big crowds.
Well, and how is the city preparing, you know, big picture? Because the previous two rallies became violent when protesters clashed with police. Four people were stabbed. Four black churches were damaged. Is there a concern about what might happen today and tomorrow?
Well, for one, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has repeatedly asked Washingtonians to stay away from downtown today and tomorrow, as have other local leaders. But, you know, a number of activists that I've spoken to say they're not going to heed that warning. They want to show up and counteract the pro-Trump group's message. D.C.'s police chief says they're increasing their presence at downtown churches and they're encouraging residents to report suspicious activity or threats. And city officials have notably also called in the D.C. National Guard to assist with crowd control. And then another thing to note is that a number of private businesses downtown have decided to shut their doors entirely, including the hotel that was a gathering place for the Proud Boys during the last two rallies.
Well, on that note, Enrique Tarrio, the leader of the far-right group, the Proud Boys that you just mentioned, was arrested in D.C. yesterday for his involvement in the burning of a Black Lives Matter banner at one of those churches. What do we know about that arrest? And I wonder if it might energize his supporters.
That's right. I mean, it very well could. D.C. police had a warrant for Tarrio charging him with burning this Black Lives Matter banner that was taken from a historic black church during the mid-December rally. And he was arrested shortly after arriving in D.C. yesterday from Miami, which is where he lives. And Tarrio, we should note, he's openly admitted that he was among the people who burned the banner. He was charged with a misdemeanor account of destruction of property and also two felony counts for possession of high-capacity ammunition feeding devices, which basically means magazines that hold extra bullets for guns. And we're not sure yet whether he'll also be charged with a hate crime.
Well, and D.C. officials are also reminding people of the city's gun laws. They're pretty tough.
Yep.
And if you're coming in from out of town, you should know that. WAMU's Michaela LaFrac, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As we know, first responders are bearing the brunt of this virus. Doctors, nurses, EMS workers, and coroners, they see the devastation of COVID-19 firsthand. Back in April, I checked in on Michael Fowler. He's the coroner for Daugherty County in Georgia. And at the time, he was working around the clock handling victims of COVID-19.
It's friends that you know, co-workers that you know, family that you know that's dying or on the ventilator is more touching and more tiresome, I say. And it take a lot out of you.
Fowler is no stranger to crisis. He actually helped in 23 major disasters, including 9/11. But he told us back in April that he'd never experienced anything as personally devastating as this pandemic. Michael Fowler joins us now from Daugherty County. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be a part of you.
Michael, a part of what made your job so hard in those early days of this pandemic is that you knew so many of the community members who were dying. And at the time, you were working around the clock as a coroner, as I mentioned. What is your job like right now?
It definitely has slowed down compared to what I was working earlier. I've had so many family members to pass, co-workers, friends in the community that I know, a lot of the religious leaders. So now it kind of slowed down compared to what we was doing. And I'm able to get a little bit more rest now compared to what I was doing during that time, because the very little rest I was getting at that time, I mean, people were just dying everywhere.
Right. I mean, at one point, Daugherty County had the most COVID-19 deaths in the state of Georgia. That number has gone down, and you're seeing that in your work. What is working there, you think?
Well, I think individuals took it serious. When they start seeing some of their friends and family members dying, they know something in our community that they need to learn about quickly and address it, because our community leaders came together and we were doing press conferences every day for a while, trying to let the people know the seriousness of this virus that was in our community. Many times people think something happened out of state or upstate or in another country, but we had never experienced anything like this in our community. So when we found out this virus was here, I think the people kind of grabbed hold and started taking more precaution.
Back in April, we still didn't know as much as we know now about how this virus is transmitted. And so you would actually wear a Tyvek suit and mask and gloves and stay 6 feet away. Has that changed at all?
Well, it's kind of died down some now, because so many people in our community have been tested now. And many times we get called out by 911. They'll let us know that someone in that house have been tested positive for the virus. So we know to take precaution. Many times the EMS already be at the scene when I get there. And a lot of times they've been trying to find out, has anyone been tested? If no one have been tested, we still wear our mask. But then sometimes we'll put on the N95 mask. And then we always wear gloves. And then we definitely know someone have the virus. You know, we put on Tyvek or apron or something else and be cautious when we go inside the house, and even dealing with the family members getting answers and questions about the deceased person. But we still always have some kind of mask on, and we always have gloves on.
In Los Angeles County, mortuary and funeral home workers are overwhelmed. I know you know this story all too well. And they're having to turn away bereaved families because they don't have enough places to store bodies. What's your advice for them and others around the country who are also doing this type of work?
Well, my heart go out to them. I know one of the funeral homes here had to get a refrigerator truck for their funeral home. They had so many bodies of deceased person. And they had to kind of like do the same thing, put them in a refrigerator truck and get to the funeral when they can, because they was backed up. But I think everyone got to keep educating the community. And I'm glad that you are doing it and informing the community that this virus is still out there and it's still serious. And we need to don't take it lightly. We need to be vigilant in what we are doing. So I think you are doing a great job of keeping it before the people. So I think that they're important.
Yes. You know, Michael, you represent one of so many people who are working nonstop. You said you have had a moment to rest. Have you had a moment to mourn? I'm thinking, how are you as we enter this next phase of the pandemic?
Well, my wife asked me that sometime, too. When are we going to take a vacation? When are we just going to back off from this? But I just feel obligated to the community. I mean, I just feel it's just a passion that I have, that I want to be there to help someone. And then when people are grieving, sometimes you can't put it off. You got to do something at that time. You got to hear them. Many family members want to know, was my loved one, did they have the virus? Do I need to go get tested? What you think they died from? So trying to be there to give them answers. My hearts go out to them, so I try to be there for them. But I just realize, too, that God's given me the strength to do what I do. And it's a ministry to me, and I feel that he's helped me through this. So, I just have to take one day at a time and keep praying. But I just feel that I owe that to my community to be there for them now.
Michael Fowler, coroner in Daugherty County, Georgia, thank you so much for your work.
Yeah, thank you, and I thank you for having me. If everyone masks up for the next 3 or 4 weeks, everyone, I think we'll have a better handle on this virus. But it can't be some and some not. Everyone got to get on the same page. I want to say thank you for having me again.
It's here and now.
Penn Station in New York City is the busiest train station in the United States, and many New Yorkers will tell you it's also one of the ugliest. It's dark, it's got low ceilings, and safe to say, a rat problem. In fact, Penn Station has been an architectural embarrassment since it opened back in 1968, replacing a much grander and more beautiful building which at the time city officials said was too expensive to maintain. But now, a new addition to Penn Station has opened across 8th Avenue in the old Farley Post Office building. The Moynihan Train Hall is named for the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. It's airy and light under an expansive glass atrium, and WNYC's Stephen Nissen has been inside. Stephen, welcome.
Hi there.
So you were inside on Friday. What's it like inside that train hall?
Well, it's quite incredible to walk into a new structure in New York City where your feet squeak on the floor. It's so clean and shiny. The marble floors almost hurt your eyes. They're so clean.
Not for long.
Right. It was, quite frankly, it was very refreshing to be in a new big open space. The waiting areas are really quite fantastic. There's beautiful wood seating. Every single seat has its own outlet and USB plug. If you're taking the Acela, there's a beautiful waiting area on the top floor overlooking the train hall with big, lush seats. It reminds you of like the heyday of flying, where there's, you know, these beautiful booths and long tables. It really looks like the kind of place you wouldn't mind being late to catch a train. It was nice. It was nice to see something new and shiny. And I spoke to a lot of New Yorkers who were like, yeah, we deserve this. We deserve something nice right now because, you know, we're still in the midst of the second wave of the pandemic, and it's brutal here. A lot of folks are suffering. So it was like a spot of bright news for the new year.
Sure. And, you know, another reason maybe people are happy to see it is because the original Penn Station was this just gorgeous building that New Yorkers still, to this day, mourn the loss of. We're talking about 50 years later. Why did it take so long to get to this point?
Right. The old one was an architectural marvel. Quite frankly, you know, it's the story of New York, the ups and the downs. At that time, they couldn't afford to keep that beautiful station running. There weren't enough passengers, quite frankly. The tide turns, you know, real estate in New Jersey actually boomed. So a lot of folks are commuting from Penn Station to New Jersey on NJ Transit. The old station was designed for, 200,000 people, but now, at least before the pandemic anyways, it was serving 700,000 people. So like you said, that old station was disgusting and the ceilings were really low. It was dark. The governor of New York frequently called it the catacombs. And it took a long time and a lot of effort and money, but actually it was the private sector, you know, combined with the public sector that got this new station built.
I see. And, you know, you said you spoke with people there when you went to this train hall. And as you know better than I do, New Yorkers are likely to have an opinion about the buildings that they're in there in the city. Tell me more. What did you hear from people who were standing there in the middle of this train hall?
Well, right. It was New Year's Day and dozens of people and families, train nerds, architecture nerds, and just people who wanted to see something fresh came out. I spoke with one woman, Christine Davis, senior citizen, she told me, who walked 3 miles to be there on New Year's Day.
This is a testament to the strength of the people and a will of the people to keep going and to not be afraid, to have beautiful structures, something for all the people. And I'm very happy to be here.
And it wasn't just her. It was a lot of people who came out to say that they can't wait to get back to normalcy. And this sort of felt like a sneak preview of what normalcy will be like. I spoke with one man who said he can't wait to start commuting again so he can come through there every day.
I recently spoke with the CEO of the MTA, which of course runs the subway system and the commuter lines in New York City and beyond. The agency is really hurting financially because of the pandemic. How does the opening of this new train hall in this sort of iconic space in the city in terms of transportation, how does that fit in with the overall plan for transportation in New York?
Well, right. At the moment, everything's sort of in a standstill. It's sort of being held in place because they can just barely afford to keep the lights running on the train systems. And in fact, you know, this train hall looks beautiful, but it doesn't add any capacity. So they can't run more trains. They can't fit, you know, more people on the tracks because the tracks themselves and the platforms underneath this new train hall were not expanded at all. The MTA is starved for money, and so is Amtrak. And Amtrak runs a tunnel between New York and New Jersey. It's the East River Tunnel, and it was badly damaged in Superstorm Sandy. Flooded, the concrete was damaged, the tracks were damaged, and those tracks are really on life support at the moment. But this new train hall doesn't address any of those issues whatsoever. And quite frankly, you know, the train hall is a drop in the bucket. You know, $1.6 billion, but the new train tracks, the new train tunnel that they need to build, you know, is several billion dollars.
There's a lot of tourists out there who haven't gotten to New York City in a long time because of this pandemic. As soon as it breaks, I'm sure they will be eager to also see this new space. Stephen Nesson, transportation reporter for WNYC in New York City. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.